butting heads over and over until we were bruised and bloody, and as band general, he had no choice but to dismiss me from service. He soon kicked Lizzie out as well, and the two of us decided to form our own group. By that time, I was broke. I had been fired from the liquor store and the factory for blowing off work to rehearse. I found a job at Warehouse Music on Sunset and Western, where I could get away with showing up whenever I felt like it. When money was really tight, I'd give blood at a clinic on Sunset to pay the bills. One morning, while I was taking the bus to Warehouse Music, I met a girl named Angie Saxon. In general, I had no interest in women except for the moment or two of pleasure they could provide me. The rest of the time, they were in the way. But Angie was different. She was a singer, and we could talk about music. Except for Angie and Lizzie, I had no friends that lasted longer than a week, and no one I could trust. Because I was always starving and amped on uppers, I often felt as if I didn't have a body. Like I was just a vibrating mass of nerves. One day, when I was feeling particularly broke and anxious, I decided to find my father. I convinced myself that I was calling him because I needed money. Money that he owed me to make up for all the years he had abandoned me. But in retrospect, I think I wanted to feel connected to someone, to talk to him, and maybe, in the process, learn something about what made me so crazy. I called my grandmother, then my mother, and they told me that last they heard he was working in San Jose, California. I called information, asked for Frank Ferrana, and found him. I wrote the number down next to the phone and downed a fifth of whiskey to work up the courage to dial it. He picked up on the first ring, and when I told him it was me, his voice turned gruff. "I don't have a son," he told me. "I do not have a son. I don't know who you are." "Go fuck yourself," I yelled into the receiver. "Don't ever call here again," he snapped back and hung up. That was the last time I ever heard his voice. I cried for hours, removing records from their cardboard sleeves and throwing them against the walls, watching them smash to pieces. I grabbed the pieces of vinyl and scraped them up and down my arms, making crisscrosses of raised red flesh, punctuated by beads of blood. Though I didn't think I could sleep that night, I somehow did, waking up in the morning strangely calm with the resolve to change my birth name. I did not want to be saddled for the rest of my life as the namesake of that man. What right did he have to say I was not his son when he had never even been a father to me? First, I killed Frank Ferrana Jr. in a song. On with the show, writing, "Frankie died just the other night. Some say it was suicide, but we all know how the story goes." Then I made it legal. I remembered that Angie was always talking about her old boyfriend from Indiana, a guy named Nikki Six, who used to play in a top 40 cover band, and later with a surf punk outfit called John and the Night Riders. I loved his name, but I couldn't just steal it. So I decided to call myself Nikki Nine. But everybody said it was too punk rock, and punk was now too mainstream. I needed something that was more rock and roll, and Six was rock and roll. So I decided that anyone who thinks surfing has anything to do with punk rock doesn't deserve such a cool name, and I soon applied to have my name legally changed to Nikki Six. It was like stealing his soul, because for years people would come up to me and say, "Nikki, dude, remember me from Indiana?" I'd tell them that I'd never been to Indiana, and they'd say, "Come on, man, I saw you with John and the Night Riders." Years later, on the Girls, Girls, Girls tour, I was channel surfing in a hotel room and saw a strange, sallow-skinned character with long hair being interviewed. I heard the words, "He's the devil," and stopped to watch. It was him, ranting and raving. "He took my name and sucked my soul out and sold it to you all. I was the original Nikki Six, and he is using my name to spread the word of Satan." Nikki Six, or John as he was now called, appropriately enough since John is the saint in the New Testament who tells of the apocalypse, had become a born-again Christian. Angie convinced me to move in with a bunch of musicians behind a flower shop across from Hollywood High School. There were wannabe rock stars everywhere in the house, sleeping in the bathtub, on the front steps, behind the sofa cushions. And somehow, one of them burned the place to the ground one afternoon. I returned from the record store to find the house smoldering, surrounded by curious high school students. With my base in hand, I always took it with me in case someone in the house stole it, I ran inside to see if I could rescue anything else of mine. I noticed that there was a piano still standing that a guy who had left town to visit his parents had been renting, so I wheeled it out of the house, around the corner, and all the way to a music store on Highland Avenue, where I sold it for $100. Angie let me move in with her in Beechwood Canyon, where I hung around all day listening to her records and dyeing my hair different colors while she earned money for us working as a secretary. I never thought about the piano again until 6 months later, when two policemen pulled up and pounded on the door looking for a guy named Frank Ferrana who had stolen a piano. I told them I knew of no one by that name. When Lizzie and I weren't trying to get our own band together, I tagged along with Angie to Redondo Beach, where she rehearsed with her band. I hated them because they were into Rush and had lots of guitar pedals and talked about hammer-ons and, most egregious of all, had curly hair. If there's one genetic trait that automatically disqualifies a man from being able to rock, it's curly hair. Nobody cool has curly hair. People like Richard Simmons, the guy from Greatest American Hero, and the singer from REO Speedwagon have curls. The only exceptions are Ian Hunter from Mott the Hoople, whose hair is more tangled than curly, and Slash, but his hair is fuzzy, and that's cool. For women, the equivalent of curly hair is being cockeyed. If there's one genetic trait in women that predisposes them to hate me, it's having a cockeye. I always fail with cockeyed women, one of whom happened to be Angie's roommate. One night I got drunk and tried to climb in her bed, and she told Angie all about it the next day. I tried to convince Angie that I thought it was her bed, but she knew me too well and kicked me out of the house. I moved into a drug-infested, prostitute-riddled Hollywood slum and concentrated on staying in my own bed and getting my band with Lizzie together. We found a dog-collar-wearing bronze giant of a drummer named Dane Rage, a keyboard player named John St. John who hauled a giant Hammond B3 organ from gig to gig, and a singer named Michael White, whose claim to fame was that he had recorded something for a Led Zeppelin tribute album once. That, right there, should have let me know that he was not the man we were looking for. That, and the fact that he had curly hair. And was kind of cockeyed. We tramped through Hollywood in high heels and tube tops, and anything else we could muster up to shock Rush fans and Led Zeppelin dinosaurs. It was 1979, and as far as we were concerned, rock and roll was dead. We were Mott the Hoople, the New York Dolls, the Sex Pistols. We were everything that no one else was into. In our alcoholic minds, we were the coolest fucking band ever, and our confidence and alcoholism attracted fanatic groupies after just a few shows at the Starwood. We called ourselves London, but what we really were was Motley Crue before Motley Crue. Except for Michael White. Everything that I despised, he worshipped. If I liked the Stones, he liked the Beatles. If I liked creamy peanut butter, he liked chunky. So we fired him for having curly hair, placed an ad in the recycler, and met Nigel Benjamin, who was a real rock and roll star in our minds, not just because he had straight hair, but because he had played in Mott the Hoople as Ian Hunter's replacement. He wrote great lyrics, and when he stepped up to the mic, he fucking wailed. He could really sing, like no one I'd been in a band with before. We had an insane keyboard player who had his own Hammond, a drummer with a big North trap set, and a British lead singer. We were on fire. I was so excited that I called my uncle at Capitol and demanded, "I want to get a hold of Brian Connolly from the suite." "What?" he asked, incredulous. "I have this amazing band, you know, and I want to send him some pictures." I sent Connolly the photos, and as a favor to my uncle, he agreed to accept my call the next week. I spent the entire day at home rehearsing what I'd say in my head. I picked up the phone and started to dial, then hung up. Finally, I worked up the courage. As soon as he picked up, I went right into my speech about London and how we were on our way to the big time and how we could use his advice or his support or any kind of instruction he might have. Maybe we could tour together one day. "Are you done, mate?" he asked. I was done. "I got your photos and music," he continued, "and I see what you're trying to do, but I can't help you. Man, I think we're going to be the biggest band in L.A., and I think it would be good for us to, he cut me off. Yeah, well, I've heard that before, mate. My advice would be to keep your day job. This kind of music is never going to make it. I was devastated. He went from being my idol to my enemy, a bitter rock star sitting on a throne of shit in his mansion in London. Well, I said, I'm sorry to hear you feel that way. And I hung up and stared at the phone for half an hour, unsure whether to laugh or cry. In the end, it just gave me more motivation to succeed and make Brian Connolly rue the day he ever insulted me. Our manager was David Forrest, a flamboyant party fiend who ran the Starwood along with Eddie Nash, who was later mixed up in the John Holmes murders, when the porn star was involved in the fatal beating of four people at a drug dealer's home in Laurel Canyon. Forrest, ever charitable, gave me and Dane Rage jobs at the club cleaning and doing carpentry in the afternoon. It worked out so that at night London would play and drop confetti and make a mess, and the next day we'd get paid to clean it up. It was through Forrest that I was introduced to the decadence that the commingling of disco and rock had brought to the L.A. club scene. I'd sit in the office with him and people like B.B. Buell and Todd Rundgren, who would poison my impressionable mind with tales of Steven Tyler overdosing and Mick Jagger getting head backstage while groupies sat around nodding off on smack. Or I'd see local heroes like Rodney Bingenheimer and Kim Fowley partying. I had all the free rum and cokes I wanted, plus I learned all about drugs whose names I had only heard of before. Real drugs, and I loved them. I was young and pretty and had long hair. I'd lean against the wall at the Starwood in stiletto heels and super tight pants with my hair in my eyes and nose in the air. As far as I was concerned, I had made it. I would sleep until I had to get up and do something to make money, like telemarketing or selling crap door to door or working at the Starwood. At night, I'd go to the Starwood and drink and fight and fuck girls in the bathroom. I really thought that I had become my fucking heroes, Johnny Thunders and Iggy Pop. Now that I look back on it, I realize how naive and innocent I was. There were no jets or sold-out stadiums then, no mansions or Ferraris. There were no overdoses or orgies with guitar necks stuck up some chick's ass. I was just some cocky little kid in a club who, like so many others before and after him, thought that a sore prick and burning nostrils meant he was king of the world.
Chapter 4 Mick. A valuable moral lesson is learned regarding the judgment of others by factors of external appearance, including but not limited to body weight and pustules in the shape of fried processed chicken. I question a lot of things and form my own opinions. They're just as valid as a rocket scientist's or anyone else's. Who says you have to believe something because you read it in a book or saw pictures? Who is it that gets to say, that's the way that it is? When everybody believes the same thing, they become robotic. People have a brain. They can figure out things for themselves, like how a UFO flies. When I was in elementary school in the 50s, at the height of the Cold War, we had duck and cover drills. They told us that if the hydrogen bomb dropped, all we had to do was get under our desks and put our hands over our heads. Today, it seems ridiculous that a desk is going to protect us from radiation and complete devastation, but it made perfect sense at the time to the supposedly intelligent and informed people we called teachers. I remember writing in big letters on my notebook the words duck and cover with quotation marks around them and a giant question mark. What a joke. That little turtle was bullshit. I used to save stacks of notebooks and sheets of paper with stuff I had written down since I was a kid. Over time, a lot of what I've written has become true. In 1976, when my top 40 band White Horse was on its last legs and ready to be shot, we were rehearsing in the living room of the house where we all lived when the bass player walked in and said, "Well, this certainly is a motley-looking crew." After rehearsal, I went upstairs to my room and wrote those words down in my notebook, Motley Crue. Then below it, in bigger letters, Motley Crue, spelled C-R-U, and said to myself that I had to have a band called Motley Crue. I wanted White Horse, who were actually a good band, to start playing originals and become Motley Crue. Why not try originals? We're starving anyway, I told them. They answered by voting me out of the band. So I left with everything. The PA, the lights, the van. I placed an ad in that classified paper, The Recycler, that read, Extraterrestrial guitarist available for any other aliens that want to conquer the Earth. I was calling myself Zorky Charlemagne at the time, so I used that name in the paper and received some real bizarre phone calls, but not from anybody who seemed sane. I ended up in a top 40 band called Vendetta, which made me enough money to buy a Marshall stack and a Les Paul. I bought another Marshall stack and Les Paul when I returned from a tour of Alaska and placed another ad in The Recycler. Usually people will write an ad that begins with the letter A, like, A righteous guitar player seeks band, just so they can be at the top of the listing. I didn't care because I knew my ad would jump no matter where it was. It read, Loud, rude, and aggressive guitarist available. The guy with the Hitler mustache from Sparks responded. But I told him that I didn't like his music and I'd be wasting his time and mine if I tried out for him. I think he respected me for that. Some cheesy band in Redondo Beach that went on to become Poison or Warrant or some other name that wrecked the 80s called because they'd seen me play at Pier 52. I didn't call them back. To quote Andy Warhol, everybody has 15 minutes of fame. To quote myself, I wish they didn't. I think Nikki finally found the ad and phoned. We talked for a little while and arranged a day to meet. I crammed my guitar and Marshall stacks into a tiny Mazda that belonged to my friend Stick and drove to North Hollywood. Nikki and I said hello like two complete strangers. Neither of us remembered having met the other before. He had changed his name, and his hair was all blown out, jet black, and hanging over his face. I wouldn't have been able to recognize him if he was my own father. It took another week or two before he asked, Hey, aren't you that weird guy who came in the liquor store one day? And I couldn't believe it. He had really grown into himself. Nikki said he'd left his old band, London, because there were too many people trying to tug the group in too many different directions. Now he was trying to put together his own project and realize his own vision. I pretended like I agreed, but I knew that he was still young and musically naive, and I could influence him to evolve my way. At that rehearsal, we played a few of the songs Nikki had written. Stick to Your Guns, Toast of the Town, Public Enemy Number One. They had this sissy guy whose name I won't mention, playing guitar. The first thing I did when I walked in was say, He ain't gonna make it. So they told me that if I wanted him out, I had to tell him. It was day one and they already had me doing their dirty work. There was also a real bony little kid there, with a giant growth on his chin that looked like a chicken McNugget. He said he'd been pushed or fallen down the steps at Gazzari's the night before and busted his lip. I don't know if that was what was on his face, but it seemed like a permanent second chin. The kid claimed that he could play the drums, though he seemed too young and scrawny to be any good. But when he started playing, he wasn't a sissy. He hit hard. His name was Tommy. And come to think of it, it wasn't Nikki who found the ad in The Recycler at all. It was Tommy. He called. He left the message. He made it happen. And man, could he play.
Part 3. Toast of the Town. Chapter 1. Tommy. Of a red-colored berry that set a young boy's heart aflame with desire, the educational opportunities afforded by a co-ed volleyball class, and other reminiscences of happy record. Dude, fuck yeah. Finally. How much room is Nikki gonna get, bro? Fuck, the dude tried to put his own mother in jail. I love him. We've practically been married for 20 years. Sometimes it's dysfunction junction over there. I'm not like that. I'm a hopeless fucking romantic. That's a part of me that a lot of people don't know about. They know everything there is to know about another part of me, but not a thing about my heart. Dude, it's bad, but it's all good. All fucking good. My fate was sealed with my first crush on this rad little girl who lived down the street from me in Covina. I used to chase her all over the place. I'd follow her around on my bicycle and spy in her window at night like a pint-sized stalker. All I wanted to do was kiss her. I had seen my mom and dad kiss, and it looked pretty cool. I figured I was ready to try it for myself. I've learned in life that if you chase something for long enough, pretty soon, it will start chasing you. After a while, my neighbors started following me around everywhere, and we became crazy about each other. One time, we somehow ended up behind a bunch of bushes in this cool, grassy, shaded area that nobody could see. The little bushes had small, bright red berries growing from them. They were the color of her lips. Without even thinking, I picked a berry off one of the bushes and held it between our mouths. Then we wrapped our lips around the berry and kissed for the first time. It felt so romantic and magical. I thought that if we kissed with this little red berry between us, we'd somehow become something else. Maybe she'd turn into a princess and I'd become a knight and take her out of Covina on my white horse. We'd gallop to my castle as the neighbors looked on, wondering who this beautiful prince and princess were. And we'd live happily ever after. Unless somebody ate or destroyed the magic berry. If that happened, we'd return to Covina and be just two dumb little kids again. That's how it's always been in my life. There's always a storm cloud lurking in the distance, waiting to fuck up everything good and perfect. I went to a dream analyst recently, and he told me I inherited that storm cloud from my mother. Her life was like that. Everything good was surrounded by tragedy. Her name was Vasiliki Papadimitriou, and she was Miss Greece in the 50s. My dad, David Lee Thomas, was an army sergeant, and he proposed to my mom the first time he ever fucking saw her. They were married within 5 days of meeting, just like Pamela and I would be almost 40 years later. He didn't speak a word of Greek. She didn't speak a word of English. They drew pictures for each other when they wanted to communicate, or she'd write something in Greek and my dad would struggle to make sense of the odd characters using a Greek-English dictionary. She tried 6 times before me to have a child. 5 times she miscarried, and when she succeeded the 6th time, my brother died within days of his birth. For some reason, they weren't supposed to be here. I don't know how she had the courage to try again. But when she became pregnant for the 7th time, she refused to even get out of bed for 9 months in case something went wrong. Just after I was born, my parents left Athens and moved to a Los Angeles suburb called Covina. It was hard for my mother. She used to be a totally rad model, and now here she was in America making a living cleaning other people's houses like a fucking servant. She was always embarrassed by her job. She was living in a new country with a stranger who had suddenly become her husband, and she had no family, no friends, no money, and hardly spoke a word of English. She missed home so much, she named my younger sister Athena. My dad worked for the L.A. County Road Department, fixing the highway repair trucks and tractors. My mom always hoped he'd make enough money so she could quit her job and hire a housekeeper, but he never did. The dream analyst guy said that my mom passed a lot of the day-to-day fear she lived with in America on to me, especially when I was a young child. She would talk to me in Greek, and I wouldn't be able to comprehend a word she was saying. I had no idea why I could understand everybody else around me, but I couldn't make out a word my mother was saying. Experiences like that, the analyst said, led to the constant fear and insecurity I feel as an adult. I walked into a session with the analyst once in a short-sleeve shirt, and he looked at my tattoos and fucking flipped out. I told him about my parents and how they used to communicate when I was a child. At my next session, he said he'd been thinking about my family all week and come to a conclusion. At a very young age, you watched people draw pictures and communicate with them. Now, you use those tattoos as a form of communication. He pointed out that a lot of the tattoos were symbols of things that I wanted in my life, like koi fish, which I got inked long before I ever had a koi pond in my house. I also have a leopard tattoo, and one of these days I'm going to have a fucking leopard. I want one on my couch just chilling when I get home from a tour. People say that you can't predict your future, that nobody knows what life has planned for them. But I know that's bullshit. It's not just the tattoo images that later became reality for me. It goes much further back. I predicted my future when I was 3, and in a childish effort to make louder and better noises, arranged pots and pans on the kitchen floor and wailed on them with spoons and knives. My friend Gerald tells me now that I knew in my soul what I wanted to do back then. And the day I started making that racket on my mom's cooking shit was the day I manifested it. But I didn't know it at the time. I was stupid. When the milkman came by playing an accordion, I decided that I wanted to learn squeeze box instead. So I abandoned the kiddie drum set that my parents had bought me in order to keep their clean dishes off the floor and started taking accordion lessons with my sister. When a dance teacher stopped by pimping lessons, my sister and I got so excited we joined a tap and ballet company, which was great because then I could dance with girls. I didn't give a shit about playing baseball in the park with the other guys. I just wanted to hold girls. After dancing, I got excited about piano, but it turned out to be just mundane fucking repetition, playing scales over and over until I wanted to kill people, starting with my piano teacher. Then I saw a guitar at a pawn shop and developed an obsession with guitar. My accordion was an electric Da Vinci, and I turned it up until the distortion was nasty and played Smoke on the Water, until my mother cracked and bought that pawn shop guitar. I played it through my accordion amplifier as loud as I could, with the windows open so that everyone in the neighborhood knew that I had a fucking guitar. I'd even take it out in the yard and rock out so that everybody could see me. I don't know why I wanted people to notice. I'm still that way. I do things because I love them, but I also want the recognition. It's brought me a lot of happiness and got me into a lot of trouble. Fortunately, no Jehovah's Witnesses stopped by the house when I was a kid because I probably would be selling Bibles today. Instead, after watching dudes in a high school marching band beat on the snares at a football game, I turned back to the drums that I never should have abandoned in the first place. My father bought me my first professional snare for Christmas. This was no cardboard box, dude, no fucking paint can or upside-down pot. And if my dad hadn't made me sit there and do my scales on the piano and learn about bars and beats and measures, I would never have picked up drumming as fast as I did. As I write this, with my father lying on his deathbed, I don't know how I can ever repay him. I'm watching him slowly die. He's probably got a year left. And when he looks at me, tears bubble out of his eyes. And when I look at him, this man who did nothing but support me, I can't help but cry. After buying me that snare, he co-signed for me so that I could buy the rest of the drum kit myself. He told me, "I won't buy it for you because then you won't respect it. But I'll help you and co-sign for it so that if you mess up and miss your payments, I'll have your back." Then he helped me build a fucking room inside the garage with insulation, carpeting, a door, double plywood walls, and soundproofing made from egg cartons. My parents would park their cars in the driveway just so that I could have a soundproofed practice room. And then, when I was ready for my first car, my father came through again and co-signed on the loan. He'd never walk a mile for me, but if I fell down while walking for myself, he'd pick me up. Now that I had my own practice room, every kid at school who had ever played or seen a guitar wanted to come over and rock the fuck out, which usually meant playing Led Zeppelin songs over and over. Not a lot of parents would let their kids do that in their house. My folks' only rule was no music after 10 p.m., and I respected that. For a while, at least. Music was all I thought about in school. My favorite classes were music and graphic design, where I'd make rock and roll t-shirts with my friends. I also dug co-ed volleyball, and that had nothing to do with music, but everything to do with rock and roll, if you know what I mean. Every day, I'd go to my 3 favorite classes, then skip the rest of school and pound on my drums all afternoon while my parents were at work. Just before my mother came home, I'd take a walk, kill some time, and then come back as if I'd just returned from school. It was a good plan until I started failing 8th grade. My teacher, Mr. Walker, would write down our grades in a little book, close it, and put it in his drawer every day. So along with a couple other kids who were failing, I hatched a plan to steal his grade book when he left the classroom to smoke his pipe. My assigned seat was in the front of the room, so when he took a smoke break one morning, I ran to his desk, bent over the top, reached around, and pulled the black grade book out of the drawer. I made it back to my seat just as he returned. As he discussed To Kill a Mockingbird, I passed the book behind me to Reggie, who raised his hand and asked to go to the bathroom. I followed him, as did another friend. We met in one of the stalls and placed the grade book on top of a closed toilet lid. Reggie took out his lighter and set the thing ablaze. We were idiots, bro. We thought that if we destroyed the book, then all our Fs would disappear and Mr. Walker would have to pass us. We were also stupid because we thought that three kids in the bathroom for 10 minutes wouldn't arouse any suspicions. As we were trying to hurry along the fire by lighting the book from different edges, the door to the stall flew open. Standing in the entrance was Mr. Walker, and his face was as red as a fire engine. It was all bad, dude. As we were all blowing on the book trying to put out the fire, he grabbed us by the fucking ears. I swear to God, my feet didn't touch the floor all the way to the principal's office. The principal had a chair by the wall, and when it was my turn to see him, he made me face it and grab the handles. "Stare at that dot on the wall," he barked. "What dot?" I asked. Then all of a sudden, the blows came, one after another, right on my fucking ass. He beat the shit out of me, then suspended me. My parents grounded me so hard. I somehow graduated to South Hills High School, where I joined the drum corps of the marching band I had admired so much when I was a kid. Because we competed against other schools, I had to learn all kinds of tricks, twirling sticks, banging on the side of the drum, and other shit that went beyond drumming and into actual theater. The bass drum guys would swing the mallets from their wrist straps while all the snare drummers would flip and click their sticks in unison as they marched in time. Everything I learned in the drum corps, I used in my playing with Motley later on. But for all everyone else in the school cared, I might as well have still been taking ballet. Everywhere I went, people called me band fag. It wasn't like I played the flute. I was a fucking drummer. It pissed me off that I was the only one who thought I was cool. The senior drum captain was a tall, dark-haired guy named Troy, who had gone through puberty too early in life. His bones seemed like they were trying to burst out of his body, and his face was still flecked with acne scars. I was only a freshman, but I was excelling quickly in the band, and pretty soon he felt that I was threatening his authority as drum captain. One day before practice, I was bending over to pick up my drum when he tapped me on the back. As I turned around, he knocked my nose to the other side of my face. I went to the hospital, where they anesthetized the area, stuck a pair of pliers up my nose, and crack! Twisted it back into place. But it never looked the same after that. It's still crooked. I never saw him again, because afterward, my parents sold their home and moved 15 minutes away. I started sophomore year at a school called Royal Oak High in the Covina/San Dimas area. It was there that I formed my first band, US 101. I asked my parents if we could rehearse in the garage, and they fucking let me. The band's guitar player, Tom, was a major surfer dude and loved the Beach Boys. Even though I thought the Beach Boys were stupid sissy shit, I played along because I was so stoked just to be jamming with an actual band. And two members even went on to form Autograph. From ballet to drum corps, I'd always been an outsider. Being in a real rock band, though, suddenly made it cool to be an outsider. And there's a big difference between being a lame outsider and a rad one. It didn't matter that my band sucked. We started playing school dances and backyard parties, everywhere they needed a band, or didn't. It was on that circuit that I first saw the coolest fucking kid in the world. He was a surfer dude with long blonde hair fluffed up high on his head, just like David Lee Roth. He dressed in sharp, all-white clothes, and he was in a band. A much better band than mine. He went to Charter Oak High, about a mile away from my school. But he was kicked out during sophomore year and started coming to Royal Oak. As soon as he walked through the double doors, wearing badass, low, hip-hugging bell-bottoms and a white muscle t-shirt, you would have thought the rapture had occurred. All the girls were speechless, in puppy love with this long-haired surfing rocker. His name was Vince Wharton. I went up to him one day after school and said, "Hey man, what's up? My name's Tommy and I play drums. I hear you're in a band." His band was called Rock Candy, and I started going to backyard parties so I could drink and watch them play. Vince had an amazing voice. He'd do Cheap Trick covers and sound exactly like Robin Zander, and he sang some sweet, sweet Aerosmith. To me, Vince was God. He was in a rad band. He was a kick-ass surfer. The girls fucking fainted with lust whenever he walked by. And there was a rumor going around that he had fathered a boy before he was even in high school. I thought I was lucky that he even talked to a skinny misfit like me. I never even imagined I'd be cool enough to actually play in a band with him. Chapter 2. Tommy. Of, about, and concerning the formation of Motley Crue, a chaotic assemblage of minstrels, journeymen, and miscreants. It was a groundbreaking moment for Sweet 19, our first gig at the Starwood. I was so psyched, because if you played the Starwood, you'd made it. Man, first time I ever fucking came to Hollywood, I went to the Starwood to see Judas Priest. I was overwhelmed. British rock stars who flew all the way to Hollywood with their equipment and leather pants, and I was seeing them. I almost lost my mind when they played Hellbent for Leather. They played the heaviest music I'd ever heard, and I imagine that they must get to bang a million chicks. Little did I know. Unlike US 101, Sweet 19 played original tunes. My girlfriend, a cheerleader named Vicky Frontier, her mother Georgia owned the Rams, and her grandmother, Lucia Pamela, recorded an infamous album about life in outer space, had told me they were looking for a drummer. We were a perfect match. Three long-haired dudes who had all failed out of high school and were going to continuation school, blowing off classes to rock out on crazy Eddie Van Halen-influenced shit. I was 17 years old, and I couldn't believe I was in this killer power trio. At the time, I noticed that there were posters all over the Starwood for a band called London. A few weeks after our gig, I went to watch London play, and man, those guys were cooler than fucking Judas Priest. They looked like chicks, like the New York Dolls or something, with crazy fucking polka dots. I was just some emaciated, scraggly Alice Cooper clone with leopard skin spandex stretched tight over my chicken legs. But they were fucking rad, and attracted tons of hot chicks. When I saw Nicky swinging his bass around on stage, I thought, what kind of dog is that? He had fucking crazy hair that came down to his cheekbones like some kind of expensive Beverly Hills puppy that had gone stray and fallen on hard times. Sweet 19 collapsed after we ran out of Eddie Van Halen guitar licks to copy. I played briefly with another band, but that fell apart after I started dating the singer's sister. Her name was Jessica, and I thought she was sexy because she was a small, part Mexican girl with natural little titties, a funny smile, and fat, puffy cheeks. The first time we hooked up, I took her back to my van and, within minutes, started going down on her. She banged her fist on the wall and screamed, "Oh my God, I'm gonna come!" I started licking her harder, and then all of a sudden she roared like some kind of desperate mountain lion, and her pussy exploded. Water shot out everywhere. She was coming like a spilled tanker, and it was the coolest fucking thing I had ever seen in my life. I just thought, oh my God, I love this girl. This is the one! Every day after rehearsal, I would pick her up in my van, we'd park somewhere quiet, and she'd squirt her shit everywhere. I'd love to just sit there and let her come on me. Eventually, however, my van started to stink. I drove my mom to the store one afternoon, and she kept asking what the smell was. I had to pretend like I didn't know. Vince later nicknamed her Bullwinkle, because he said she had a face like a moose. And maybe she did, but I didn't care. She was opening crazy sexual doors for me. She was my first real girlfriend, and I thought that all girls came like that when they got excited. Once I discovered that I was wrong, it was hard to break up with her. The only other girl I ever met who could do that was the friend of a 6-foot, part Indian porn star named Debbie Diamond. Years later, when Bullwinkle was just a soggy memory, I was working with Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails at A&M Studios. It was his bassist, Danny Lohner's birthday, so I brought Debbie and her friend over as a birthday present. After shooting grapes out of her pussy to entertain us, Debbie's friend sat on the piano while Debbie ate her out. All of a sudden, the girl threw her head back, moaned, and shot a stream 6 foot through the air right into a fruit bowl at the other end of the room. So, as I was fucking Bullwinkle and looking for another band, Sweet 19's guitarist Greg Leon started jamming with Nicky, who had left London and was trying to put a new group together. Nicky had seen Sweet 19 play that night at the Starwood and liked my style. Greg gave him my number, and I went to meet him at the Denny's at Burbank Boulevard and Lancashire in North Hollywood. I was so nervous because I was a little punk-ass kid. In my mind, because Nicky could sell out weekends at the Starwood and the Whiskey, that made him a huge rock god. When he sat down across from me, I grew even more intimidated because I couldn't see who I was talking to behind this spiky black hair. I was like, where is this guy? I wanted to order him dog biscuits, but I don't know if he had a sense of humor. I still don't know. After lunch, we went to this little shit shack house that was barely standing in North Hollywood. He was freeloading off some girl named Laura Bell, a drummer in a band called The Orchids, who he had met through Kim Fowley. He played me a bunch of demos he'd been working on, and instinctively, I began playing the drums on the table, just like I used to in the kitchen when I was a kid. Our energy was the same, and we instantly hit it off. It was clear that we were going to do something together really quickly. Nicky was a driven dude, and I had that same obsession. We wanted to blow up the scene, rule the strip, and fight or fuck anything that moved. A couple days later, I drove my drum set to Nicky's, and we started jamming. Just bass and drums, on the warped floor in the front room of his house. The room served as a kitchen, living room, dining room, rehearsal space, and office, with a closet that doubled as Nicky's bedroom. Every few minutes during rehearsal, Nicky would pick up the telephone, dial a number, and try to sell somebody light bulbs. That was his job. The wood on the walls of the house was rotted and split, and bugs would come crawling out and attack whatever food we left laying out. If you made a sandwich, you had to keep it in your hands the whole time, otherwise some insect tribe would devour it. I was psyched to be in another band with Greg Leon, but fucking Nicky threw Greg out. Greg was a great guitarist. Him and Eddie Van Halen were probably the best players on the scene. But he was a very regular guy, and Nicky didn't like that. He said that Greg didn't have the edge that the New York Dolls and the Stooges did. He wanted everybody to look and think exactly like he did. We found a replacement guitar player, Robin, through an ad in The Recycler. Robin was pretty talented, but he was a pansy, and everyone knew it. He tucked his shirt into his pants, washed his hands before touching his guitar, warmed up by playing scales, and in general, acted as if he'd actually gone to college for a guitar degree. All he had going for him was cool hair. We continued to look through The Recycler, hoping to find a second guitarist who was an ugly and crazy enough son of a bitch to counterbalance Robin. One day I found the right ad. Loud, rude, and aggressive guitarist available. I called and left my number for the dude, and a week later, there was a timid knocking on Nicky's front door. We opened the door, and there was this little troll standing outside with black hair down to his ass and high-stacked platform shoes with practically a whole roll of duct tape wrapped around them to hold them together. He looked like a flat-broke, painfully shy, freaky-looking relative of Cousin It. I was laughing so hard, I called to Nicky, "Come here! You gotta check this dude out!" When Nicky and him were standing there face-to-face, it was like the Addams Family meets Scooby-Doo. And Nicky pulled me aside, excited. "I can't believe it," he said. "Here's another one, like us." Trailing behind Cousin It, carrying a Marshall stack, was a little dude named John Crouch, or Stick, a tag-along whose chief value in life seemed to be the fact that he owned a car, a little Mazda that, on this wet spring day, had a speaker cabinet sticking out of one window and a guitar neck out the other. To be fair to Stick, he also had a talent for fetching burritos. We set up Mick's equipment, and Nicky showed him the opening riff of Stick to Your Guns. Mick watched intensely, slouching and rubbing his anxious hands together like a praying mantis, then grabbed his guitar and played the shit out of it, making the riff so distorted and insane that we couldn't even recognize it anymore. I didn't actually know how to judge whether someone was a good guitarist or not. I was more impressed with the sheer volume of his playing than anything else. And I liked his trippy look and sound. It was as if he'd come from another planet populated by a species so sonically advanced that they didn't need to take baths. When he was through, Cousin It turned to me, beady eyes glowing through his tangle of hair, and spoke, "Let's go get some schnapps." We picked up a gallon of schnapps at the liquor store, got plastered, and jammed for an hour. Then Cousin It spoke again. He pulled Nicky and I aside and muttered something about Robin. Then he turned to Robin and told him, like a cranky old man. You're out of here. There's only one guitar player in my band, and that's me. We didn't even need to discuss whether Mick was right for the band or not. The dude was already in. Robin looked at Nicky, and then at me, and neither of us spoke a word in his defense. His face grew cloudy, then red, as he dropped his guitar and burst into tears. He really was a pansy. After Robin took a shit home, Nicky dyed my hair black so that it would match his and mix. And they encouraged me to get my first tattoo, Mighty Mouse, my all-time fucking favorite cartoon hero. He reminded me of myself. He's little, and I'm skinny. We're both always trying to save the day, and we both always get the girl in the end. I had the artist design a tattoo of Mighty Mouse crashing through a bass drum with sticks in his hands. Nicky, Mick, and I started rehearsing every day, and it was amazing how many new songs Nicky kept coming up with. Afterward, we'd hang out at the Starwood like we were already rock stars. All we were missing was a singer. We auditioned a round, dumb fellow named Odin, who sang in a voice somewhere between the Cult and the Scorpions. He was an amazing singer, but Nicky didn't like him because he didn't sound like Brian Connolly from The Suite. Odin's other problem was that he was very uptight about this pair of ultra-clean white gloves he always wore. He was under the impression that the gloves constituted having a look, and we tried not to say anything to the contrary because he was all we had. We scammed our way into his studio to record some of Nicky's songs. Stick to Your Guns, Toast of the Town, Nobody Knows What It's Like to Be Lonely, and the Raspberries tune, Tonight. They only gave us 2 hours, so when we ran out of time, Nicky made me go fuck the engineer. Her teeth stuck out of the side of her head like the air spout in a beach ball, but she was nice and had a decent body. She took me back to her place, and she had the fucking coolest bed. It had a mosquito net around it, and I had never experienced anything like that. I was a little slut back then, trying to taste all the flavors, so I told her, "Wow, I'd love to fuck in that thing." We had a good time, and she made sure we got free studio time until we wore out our welcome. During the last song we recorded for our demo, Toast of the Town, Odin refused to take off his gloves to clap in the background. He thought that removing his gloves would ruin his mystique, despite the fact that the only mystique he had was the mystery of how he had such a good voice. Nicky was enraged when Odin wouldn't clap like The Suite did in Ballroom Blitz, and Mick hated him anyway because he thought he was a fat fuck, a shitty singer, and a closet spiritualist. "I don't like that guy," Mick kept muttering during rehearsals. "He's a hippie, and I hate hippies." I told Nicky, "Mick doesn't think Odin's God." "Fuck no," Mick said. "I want that skinny blonde fucker I saw at the Starwood the other night, in that band Rock Candy." "You mean Vince?" I asked. "Hell yeah, I mean Vince." Cousin It scowled at me. "That's the guy. I don't even care if he can sing or not. Did you see what he was doing with that crowd? Did you see what he was doing to those girls, and the way he carried himself on stage?" "I went to school with that fucker," I told him. "Girls love him." I had given Vince my number at his show, but he never called. After we fired Odin, I dropped by Vince's house, gave him a demo tape, and begged him to audition with us. We waited for weeks for Vince to call or come by, but he never did. Finally, I broke down and called him again. "I've been trying to reach you," Vince said. "I accidentally washed my jeans with your number in them and couldn't get a hold of you." "Listen," I told him. "This is your last chance, dude. You gotta check out this band I'm in. The stuff we're working on will blow your mind. And Nicky Six is in the band, and we've got this rad guitar player who looks like Cousin It from the Addams Family." "Okay," Vince said. "My band fucked me over the other night, and I'm on the verge of quitting. I'll tell you what, I'll come by on Saturday. Where are you gonna be?" Saturday was a nice day. The sun was out, and a cool breeze was blowing. I was drinking schnapps, Nicky was chugging Jack Daniels, and Mick was sipping his Kahlua outside IRS rehearsal studios in Burbank, when Vince pulled up in a 280Z with this girl who we nicknamed Lovey on the spot, because she was blonde, rich, and stuck up like Lovey Howell from Gilligan's Island. She got out of the car and looked us over like she was his manager.
"Well, I have to check out the guitar player because he's got to be really good if he's going to play with you, baby," she cooed.
getting on all our nerves instantly. Vince stood there like a little kid, half cocky and half embarrassed, with platinum blonde hair exploding out of his head like fireworks. Nikki gave him some lyrics, and he started singing. He wasn't right on top of the song, but he hit all the right notes and stayed in key. And something else started happening. His squeaky, high-pitched voice combined with Nikki's ratty, out-of-time bass playing, Mick's over-amped guitar, and my way-too-busy and excited drumming. And it sounded right. Despite all the background vocals from Lovey, who kept complaining that the songs weren't right for Vince. On the spot, Nikki started rewriting his songs for Vince's voice, and the first result was Livewire. We were Motley Crue right then. At that fucking moment, we created one of our classic songs 5 minutes into our first jam with Vince. I couldn't believe it. Missing Persons were rehearsing next door, and we got so excited that, just to be assholes, we grabbed the padlock hanging on the outside of their door and locked them in their studio. I don't know how they got out, or if they ever did.
Chapter 3 Vince. Concerning a fateful decision worthy of eternal remembrance and a daring escape from forced incarceration. I was really into white. I'd wear white satin pants with white leg warmers, Capizio shoes, chains around my waist, and a white t-shirt that I had ripped up the sides and sewn together with lace. I dyed my hair as white as I could get it and fluffed it until it added half a foot to my height. I was singing with Rock Candy at the Starwood, and life didn't get any better than that. Then Tommy showed up at one of our shows and tried to fuck everything up. I hadn't seen him in a year since I'd left continuation school, and he was sporting bright leather pants, stiletto heels, dyed black hair, and a ribbon around his neck. He was actually starting to look cool. "Holy shit," I blurted. "What did you do to yourself?" "I'm in a band now, dude," he said, "with those guys over there." He gestured to two other black-haired rockers in the corner. I recognized one of them as the crazy, drug-addled loser bassist in London. The other was older and very serious-looking, not the type of person who comes to the Starwood to get laid. From the corner, the older guy was looking me up and down like I was prized beef. "I told them about you, bro," Tommy said. "They saw you tonight and they're stoked. I know you're in a band, dude, but come down and jam with us. We've got some cool motherfucking shit going on." Tommy asked me to audition with his band the next weekend. I was happy in Rock Candy, but I agreed anyway so that I wouldn't hurt his feelings. He had really helped me out when I left home in high school. He let me sleep in his van. And after his parents found out there was some homeless kid living in their driveway with all his clothes packed into a Henry Weinhardt case, they let me sleep on Tommy's bedroom floor until I found a new place to live. I was working at the time as an electrician, building a McDonald's in Baldwin Park. For job security, I started dating the boss's daughter, Leia, a tall, vaguely attractive bisexual blonde who, through some sort of elaborate mental airbrushing, believed that she looked like Rene Russo. She would show people modeling photos of Rene Russo and say they were pictures of her, which I actually believed. Leia, whom the band would later rename Lovey, was a filthy rich drug addict and bought me my first leather pants for $500 to wear on stage. I started living with her and driving her 280Z, but she drove me crazy. And I was stuck with her, not just because of the money, the car, the house, and the job, but because she had taught me how to inject cocaine and I was hooked. We would sit on the floor in her bathroom and shoot each other up while her parents ate or slept down the hall. One morning, after a 4-day binge without sleep, my body began shutting down on me. It was 7 a.m. and I had to go to work. I vomited all over the car on the ride down the hill. I couldn't keep anything down. On the McDonald's job, I started hearing voices, seeing people who weren't there, and actually having conversations with them. Every few minutes or so, an imaginary dog would run by, and I'd look off into the distance trying to figure out where it had gone. I came home from work that night and slept for almost 20 hours. I woke up, shot up, and was just beginning to see straight when Tommy dropped by. He had a tape of songs for me to learn to sing. I listened to them and tried to keep from vomiting or laughing. There was no way I was going to play with this lame band, if you could call them a band. They didn't even have a name. So I blew off rehearsal, and when Tommy called to see what had happened, explained I'd accidentally washed the pair of jeans that had his number in them. And he believed me. I never even washed my clothes. I never wore jeans, and besides, I knew exactly where Tommy lived. I could have stopped by if I'd wanted to talk to him. A few days later, I heard that they'd found a singer, and I was happy for them. It meant I wouldn't have to hide from Tommy anymore when I saw him around the neighborhood. The next week, Rock Candy was supposed to play a house party in Hollywood. I showed up in a full white satin uniform, but our guitarist and bass player never arrived. I stood there like a fucking overdressed idiot, along with our drummer, while a house full of people shouted for music for 2 hours straight. I was fucking pissed. When I called the guitarist that night, he said he didn't want to play rock and roll anymore. He'd cut off his long blonde hair, bought a closet full of skinny ties, and decided that Rock Candy was going to be a new wave band. The next day, Tommy happened to call, and he said that their new singer wasn't working out. He was lucky. He got me when I was weak. When Motley Crue came on the scene, it was less as a band than as a gang. We'd get drunk, do crazy amounts of cocaine, and walk the circuit in stiletto heels, stumbling all over the place. The Sunset Strip was a cesspool of depravity. Prostitutes in spandex and needle-thin heels walked up and down the streets. Punks sat in clusters all over the sidewalk, and huge lines of new waivers wearing black, red, and white stood in block-long lines outside each club. Kim Fowley walked up and down Sunset, grabbing girls and throwing them in bands, while Rodney Bergenheimer strutted into clubs like the squat beige mayor of L.A., able to make or break bands with a single spin on his radio show. Every weekend, huge gangs of kids from North Hollywood, Sherman Oaks, and Sun Valley flooded onto the scene, leaving a thick cloud of Aquanet hairspray hanging over the strip. Whenever we weren't performing, we'd make the circuit. The Whiskey, the Roxy, and the Troubadour, nailing posters four at a time on each wall and lamppost. If every other band had one poster on a wall, we had to have four. That was Nicky's rule. I was 18 and too young to get in most places, so I'd use Nicky's birth certificate, which said Frank Farana. Everyone at the door knew who I was from Rock Candy, but they let me in anyway. When the clubs began to close, we'd go to the Rainbow. The place was set up like a circle, with the coolest rockers and richest deviants sitting at the center tables. Guys had to be 21 to come into the club, but girls could be 18. The guys would sit at their regular spots, and the girls would walk around the ring until they were called over to someone's empty chair. They would keep circling, like dick buzzards, until you filled your table with them. Afterward, everyone would spill out into the parking lot. Randy Rhoads, Ozzy Osbourne's guitarist, would be hanging upside down from a tree screaming while junkies tried to score dope and everyone else tried to scam on girls. Soon, with Robin Crosby and Stephen Piercy from Rat, who were only playing Judas Priest covers at the time, we started calling ourselves the Gladiators and giving each other titles like Field Marshal and King. One night, Nicky and I met strawberry blonde identical twins who were in the Double Mint Gum commercials and went back to their house. Afterward, we still couldn't tell which girl was which, so we'd have to wait each night at the Rainbow until they came up to us and said hi, because we didn't want to walk up and grab the wrong girl. Even though we couldn't afford coke, we could always sniff it out. We'd find someone who was holding and throw them into Tommy's Chevy van, which became our party truck. After the Rainbow each night, we'd walk to Santa Monica Boulevard, where all the young rockers and actors who never made it were pimping themselves. We'd scrounge up enough money to buy an egg burrito from Noggles. Then we'd bite the end off and stick our dicks into the warm meat to cover up the smell of pussy so that our girlfriends didn't know we were fucking anything stupid or drunk enough to get into Tommy's van. I didn't know what to think of Mick. He was crazy. He'd sit across the club from me scribbling on a piece of paper. Then he'd bring it over and it would say something like, "I'm gonna kill you." His face was all scruffy and unshaven, and he used to bite Tommy's nipple all the time. All Tommy would do is weakly swat him away and say, "Cut it out, that chafes." Through his day job at the Starwood, Nicky somehow managed to talk his boss into letting us play our first shows there. Two sets on Friday and Saturday opening up for Y&T. And even on stage, we acted more like a gang than a band. Mick was jittery, because we'd never run through a complete show in rehearsal before. We didn't even know what our set list would be until Nikki taped a sloppy handwritten sheet of paper onto the stage floor at the last minute. During our first song, Take Me to the Top, people were yelling, "Fuck you," and flipping us the bird. Then one meathead in a black AC/DC shirt hawked a loogie that landed on my white leather pants. Without even thinking, I leapt off the stage mid-phrase and put him in a headlock and started pummeling him. I looked back, and Nikki had his white Thunderbird bass over his head. He swung it forward like a circus strength game mallet and cracked it over some guy's shoulder blade. If there was a bell on the guy's head, it would have gone through the roof. We were so loose that I couldn't tell where one song ended and the next began. But we looked good and fought even better. By the end of the second set that night, we converted most of our enemies into fans. They told their friends, and even more people came to see us the next night. When Y&T came out for their second set on Saturday, half the room had emptied. The next time we performed with Y&T, we would be the headliners. One of our first big fans was David Lee Roth. Just a year before, when Van Halen played the Long Beach Arena, I was in the parking lot bootlegging concert t-shirts. Now, Roth was introducing my band. Though we all knew it was not because he loved the music, but because he liked picking up the girls who came to see us, we were flattered. We were an unsigned, nothing band. He was a rock star. After our first show at the Troubadour, David came up to me. "Vince," he said, "do you know anything about the music business?" "Yeah, you get gigs and play music," I answered. "No," he said, "that's not what you do. Meet me tomorrow at Cantor's Deli on Fairfax at 3 p.m. The next day, David pulled up in his big Mercedes-Benz with his skull and crossbones painted on. He sat me down and launched into a monologue on the rock business. He named hustlers to avoid, scams to watch out for, and contract clauses to eliminate. "Don't go with the small distribution company," he said between mustard-dripping bites of pastrami. "You have to have your records in Tahiti. If they're not in Tahiti, they aren't anywhere else." And he went on. "Don't just sign with any manager. Don't take a deal only for the money. You have to watch where the money goes and how it comes back." Everything he had learned in the past 7 years he shared with me out of the sheer goodness of his alcohol-addled heart. I had no idea what he was talking about, because I didn't know anything about the business. I proved that the very next day, when I turned around and made one of the stupidest business mistakes in my career. I signed a 10-year management deal with a construction worker who knew even less about the industry than I did. I met him after Mick Chauffeur and burrito getter Stick started bringing his sister to rehearsal, where we were recording the songs that would become our first single, Stick to Your Guns, and Toasted the Town. She looked exactly like Stick, except she had only one tooth and a weird contraption that looked like a snake wrapped around her hair. She was so ugly that even Tommy wouldn't sleep with her. Her husband was a suspicious-looking, rail-thin construction company owner with a brain the size of Barney Fife's, but a heart bigger than a stripper's tit.